be here, and with characteristic extraordinary hospitality, Gabby has opened her home to us. So I greet you on her behalf, and we'll convey to Gabby everyone's greetings, and that we all send our warmest regards. Robin, do you want to take one of those sheets on your way, and you need a Tanakh for this? I also, echoing what Harriet said, really want to encourage you to consider coming to Nishmat for the summer program, because Nikki Katz is not here with us today, but she heard me saying, come, become a yeshiva student for 3 weeks, and she came last summer, and she's coming again this summer, and she said it was extraordinary, really, the opportunity to immerse herself, and wherever you're holding to enhance your fluency, whether it's in Gemara or in some other area, is a wonderful opportunity. So I'm speaking to everyone. Okay. There's a Gemara in Megillah, which you may or may not be familiar with, that I'd like to start out with, and I'd like to pose a question on it. If you look, you see in Megillah Yud Bet Amud Aleph, it says, Shalu Talmidav et Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Mipnei ma nitchayvu soneihem shel Yisrael shebaoto hador klaya. His disciples asked Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, you're about to have use of what we call in Hebrew Lashon Sagi Nahor, when rather than say something which reflects ill on Israel, sometimes you use the opposite language, but everyone knows you're talking about us and not them. So why did the enemies of Israel in that generation deserve annihilation? The enemies of Israel do not refer to the enemies of Israel, they refer to Israel. During the time of the Megillah, why did Israel deserve annihilation? Amar lahem imru atem. In the Socratic style of a good teacher, he said, you tell me. Amrulo, mipnei shenehenu misudato shel oto rasha. It was because they enjoyed Achashverosh's feast that they deserved death. He answered, im kein shem shushan yehargu shem chol haolam kulo al yehargu. He said, if your thesis is correct that they deserve death because they enjoyed Achashverosh's feast, well, who do we know who attended Achashverosh's feast? If you look at the beginning of Megillah, you see the guest list for 180 days, and the Jews are not listed in that guest list. The guest list, they're not excluded from the guest list, but they're not listed specifically in the guest list. The guest list is, look at Pasuk Gimel in Megillah, Bishnat Shalosh Lamacho, Samishte L'chol Sarav V'Avadav, Chel Paras U'Madai. He made a feast for his ministers and Avadav, Avdei HaMelech, both in the book of Esther and the book of Daniel and the other books of the period, does not refer to the servants around the house. It refers to members of the court. Members of the court are called Avdei HaMelech. So he made a feast for all of his ministers and the members of the court. Chel Paras U'Madai, the military, Hapartamim v'Sarei Hamdinot. The Partamim are the aristocrats, and Sarei Hamdinot are the local heads of states. The Jews are not listed, but the Jews are included in the second banquet, because the second banquet was for whom? In Shushan, it was Migadol v'Ad Katan. It was all-inclusive, from the greatest to the lowest. So the Talmidim came to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and said, why did the Jews in that generation deserve death? And he tells them, tell me, you tell me. And they said, because they enjoyed, they savored the banquet of that evildoer. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai answers back to them and says, if that's the case, those in Shushan should deserve extinction, not the others. Shebchol haolam al yehargu. Those in the rest of the world should not be destroyed. Amru lo emor ata. So they said, since you've destroyed our thesis, now you tell us what you think. Amar lehem mipnei shishtachavu latzelem. They said, he said, because they bowed to the statue. Now the Talmidim answered back, "Amru lo v'chi maso panim yesh badavar." They said, "But it was just a matter of face." In other words, when they bowed to the statue, they weren't really intending to worship the statue, but they just did it because that's what they needed to do in order to survive in that environment. So he answered, "Hein lo asa amar nahem, hein lo asu ela lifnim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asa imahem ela lifnim." They only, for them it was only a matter of face. The Almighty also did just a matter of face. I want to try to understand this, Gemara. It's putting two theses in front of us. Why did they disturb destruction? What do you think that means? What's he referring to? What does it mean when he says, "Why did the Jews disturb destruction?" Where is he getting? Where is he getting that the Jews disturb destruction?
Yeah. But that was Haman's intention.
But God saved us. So why is he saying that the Jews deserved what? The Jews deserved destruction. God saved us because we didn't deserve destruction. Haman intended to destroy us. Paro intended. Others intended. That doesn't mean we deserved it. What's he commenting on? Yes?
They all prayed.
Okay, they fasted, and the decrees were eventually not canceled, but they were replicated for the Jews. It seems to me what he's saying is, why didn't God intervene 11 months earlier? That if you look at the calendar and you see the days of the fast were in the month of Nisan. When the proclamation went out, it was in the month of Nisan, which is the month of Pesach, mid-Nisan. Yudalid Tetvav Tetzayin Nisan. When did God save them? The following Adar, which is 11 months later, the 12th month. And I believe what they're saying is, so why did God wait so long? If God was going to save the Jews, why did he wait so long? And it seems to me that their very unhappy answer was that the Jews needed... the Jews needed not so gentle a path where they sit. They needed to be shaken up. They needed some kind of tiltul as a result of one or the other theses that are here. God could have saved them. What did God wish? God wished them to be a little bit uncomfortable for 11 months. God wished them to feel the imminent annihilation, and then he was prepared to save them. But not before they got a little bit of a zetz, a very deeply existential zetz that shook them up from where they were. It seems to me that that's what the Gemara is saying. And there are these two theses, and I'd like to work with both of them today and try to understand them in terms of the time of the Megillah. The comment of the Talmidim is, what did they do wrong? Nehnu misudato shel oto rasha. They enjoyed the suda of that evil man. The alternative of Rabban Shimon Bar Yochai is that they hishtachavu latzelim. So let's work with both of these for a minute. In order to understand this, we've got to put it into context. Now, I think probably contemporary translations of the Megillah translate the name Achashverosh as Achashverosh. Is that so, or does someone else have...
Yes.
Yeah, I remember as a child reading about Ataxerxes. The Ata we can put aside, but the Xerxes we can't put aside. Xerxes was the fourth king in the Achmanid dynasty, Persian dynasty. The historians speak of 10 kings. Achashverosh is not mentioned amongst them. So who is Achashverosh? The name Achashverosh appears not just in the Book of Esther, it appears also in the Book of Ezra. But how does this align with Persian history? Who is Achashverosh? So there has been a tendency for many years to identify him with the fourth Persian king. When I say the fourth, the Persian conquest was with Cyrus the Great of Persia, who was already a Persian king before he conquered Babylonia. But he conquered Babylonia, the glorious Babylonian Empire, in 539 before the Common Era. We're going to be moving downwards. And after Cyrus, the next king, who is not mentioned in Tanakh, Cyrus is mentioned in Tanakh, is Cambyses.
It's
thereafter, Cambuzi or Cambyses. Thereafter, in 522, another king whom we know well, both from Tanakh and from general history, came to the throne, and that was Darius the Great, or in Hebrew, Dariavish. The Hebrew is presumably closer to the Persian. During the reign of Dariavish, the Mikdash was rebuilt. The second temple was rebuilt. So the proclamation for the Jews to return to Tzion, Shivat Tzion, Hatzarat Koresh, the Cyrus Declaration, was issued in 539 before the Common Era. The Jews were called upon in a proclamation that sounds as if the Jewish Agency authored it, and I think that probably I see the fingerprints of Daniel on the Cyrus Declaration. Just as, you know, Chaim Weizmann had to do with the Balfour Declaration, there's what went on in the back room, and I'm sure there's what went on in the back room for the Cyrus Declaration. So put your history in place. At 522, before the Common Era, is when Darius the Great, King Dariavish HaGadol, came to the throne, and 520, the reconstruction of Mikdash was resumed, and it was finished in 515. 486, the fourth king of the dynasty, Xerxes, came to the throne. And the reason that Ahasuerus is identified with Xerxes is the stories coalesce, and also the name coalesces. He's called Xerxes in Greek. We know him from Herodotus, the historian. But the Persian name was Hashiarsh. Now, look at Perek Yud in the Megillah. Is there anyone here who's a Megillah reader? Happy.
Just one chapter.
Which one? Okay, you're not going to help us today. Learn the rest of the Megillah, Chavi. Nobody else here is a... Okay, Perek Yud? Just little pieces? Ladies, I came all the way from Israel to lecture you. Learn the whole Megillah. What, Perek?
I can read the first chapter, half of the first chapter.
I want the end. Look at Perek Yud. Look at Perek Yud. Now, the first Perek Yud is very easy to learn. The first time I looked at a Megillah,
it has no Ahasuerus in Perek Yud.
Terrific. Take a look. Not just is the cantillation missing.
It's not written completely.
It's the first time I looked at a Megillah, I thought to myself, oh no, this Megillah is not kosher. Because the word Ahasuerus is miswritten. The answer is it is not miswritten, and it is this that helps us identify Ahasuerus with Xerxes. Because look at the letters of the word. If you were to read it as it's written, what would you read? You would read Ahasuerus. Now, go further with this. If you look at the book of Ezra, and you see how the Parsiim, the Persians, are called in the book of Ezra, the Persians are called Afarsayeh. An aleph is added on to Parsiim, or Parsayeh, Afarsayeh. So now, delete that aleph, and look at the name. The addition of an aleph is not uncommon in changing a Persian word into a Hebrew word. So delete the aleph, just as you have Afarsayeh in Aramaic, but it's Parsiim in Hebrew. Now look at the word without the aleph, and what do you see? You see, chashash, or chashiyash, because if you read it without the nekudot, you can read it both ways. Why is there a tendency to identify chashiyash with, or chashiyash or Xerxes? I think I'm going to be calling him chashiyash. It's a little bit easier. Chashrash, but it's Chashiyash and it's Xerxes. Why is there a tendency, and what does that have to do with the Gemara in Megillah? As follows. The Persian kings wanted to rule the world. That was their aspiration. And Darius the Great almost did it. Are you familiar with, we're all familiar with the name Marathon. Are you familiar with the Battle of Marathon, the defeat at the Battle of Marathon? Okay. Well, the Darius had almost the entire world, known world of the time, conquered. In order to understand what I'm saying, you have to understand what the known world was. In the Megillah, we read that the Persian Empire stretched from Hodu to Kush, Kush being Ethiopia. We don't have the northern border, because the northern border of the Persian Empire was their problem. But the Persians had conquered, think of Central Asia, you know, the Urals, the they got as far east as India. North Africa was not in Persian control. The entire Middle East was in Persian control. North Africa was not in Persian control. It was in the hands of the Carthaginians, who were their allies. So it was, for all intents and purposes, under Persian control. Then go a little southward in Africa to Central Africa, that's controlled by the Persians. The Persians were aware that there were barbarians that were far west in Europe. They knew that Europe existed. Up until Central Europe, they controlled. If you went further in Europe, the Persians did not control, but they knew that there were barbaric tribes there. But if you looked at the civilized world, the Persians controlled the civilized world, except for one little piece, which was Greece. That's why when you talk of Hodu to Kush, you're doing something very delicate. You're not you're giving the east-west borders, but you're not giving the north-south border, because the northern border was what was the splinter in their skin. So Darius the Great set out to conquer the world, the entirety of the civilized world as he knew it. And he was defeated in the Battle of Marathon, which was around 490 before the Common Era. It was interesting because the numbers of the Persian army overwhelmed the Athenians, but the Athenians nevertheless succeeded, and the Persians retreated in great shape. Now this Xerxes, or Chashiyash, take whichever name you wish, after coming to the throne, what we know about him, we know from the historian, the Greek historian Herodotus. Herodotus spent most of his active life in exile in Turkey. He was almost contemporary. He was in the 5th century before the Common Era. So what we know from outside the Megillah, we know basically from Herodotus. And what he tells us is that Xerxes, in the 3rd year of his reign, called together a council of all of his generals in order to try to undo the great shame of Darius's defeat. And when he gave apparently a rousing talk to all of his generals, and in this rousing talk, which Herodotus records part of, he said, "We will go into battle, and we will skies of Zeus, the heavens of Zeus." Zeus was, of course, the top Greek god. "The heavens of Zeus will be our borders." In other words, he's saying, what does he mean by the heavens of Zeus? Herodotus, the sky is the limit. The sky is going to be our border. When he calls it the heavens of Zeus, Herodotus is using his own term, the Greek god. But what Xerxes was saying is that that's going to be our border. That's going to be our border, and he's out to conquer the entire world. And he went in the third year of his rule. He went out on this battle with, let's just say Herodotus is exaggerating a little. He says he had 5,700,000 soldiers. So you want to take off 1,000,000 for exaggeration? And he had an armada, which was basically provided by the Carthaginians, of 225,000 ships. And he went out in order to attack the Greeks and to conquer the Greek cities, and then he was going to rule the world. And he succeeded in his initial attack. The sheer numbers are telling us that this was a world war. So he succeeded in his initial attack, but then the Greeks fought back, and he was defeated in the famous battle of Salamis, and retreated in the 12th year of his reign back into Persia. What are these? What are you hearing when I tell you this story? You're hearing the third year, and when you hear the third year, you suddenly say, ah, this could explain why he's having a banquet for 180 days. That what he's doing is, these are the war preparations, that everyone is coming together and he's rallying the empire behind the attack on Greece. And then in what about the 12th year of his reign? That's the year in which Haman is throwing the lots, casting the lots, and you say to yourself, well, he retreated into his own empire, and then this is the time that he started focusing. He started focusing inward, and that's why this was good timing for Haman to attract him to look at the Jews. Now, if you
would also say that a war of that such a massive war would have been incredibly expensive, and he would have had a great need to fill his treasury.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And that is why when Haman makes his suggestions, that according to this thesis, this identification, which is not Chazal's identification, but this is, you know, the historians give us a number of possibilities when they look at the dynasty. There is someone who identifies Ahasuerus as much later in the dynasty, towards the end of the dynasty, but there really isn't. It's all theory, but this third year and 12th year and the need for money, the need for financing, the focusing inward when returning from battle, could explain a number of things about the Megillah. And if you go back to Chazal, and Chazal gave us these two options. Chazal said, "Mipnei man nitchayvu sonehem shel Yisrael shebaoto hador klaya." Translated, "Why did Israel deserve destruction?" So Rashbi's thesis is "Mipnei sheishtachavu latzelem." Now you say, "What selim? What image, what graven image, what were they bowing to? Why in Rashbi's opinion did Israel, in bowing to the Tzelem, commit such a grave sin that they deserve destruction?" And again, I repeat, deserve destruction, according to my understanding, is why did God not intervene earlier, and why did God subject Israel to 11 months in which they felt Evel Gadol LaYehudim? Chazal say, what is Evel Gadol LaYehudim? That Kamin Hagoshel Olam, Avel gets less, mourning decreases. But when you know that you are moving towards destruction, mourning increases. And they were subject to Avel Gadol for 11 months. And there was a countdown towards the imminent destruction. And Rashbi says, because Hishtachavu Latzelem. Now, what Selem could be referred to? There's only one Selem that we know about in Tanakh. There is, the Midrash tells us that Haman engraved on his breastplate an image, and he intended that when anyone bowed to him, they bowed to that image. But virtually all of the Rishonim, when they look at the Gemara, Hishtachavu Netzelim, they say exactly the same thing. There's one Selim we know of in Tanakh, and that's what?
The Egel.
The Egel isn't referred to as a Tselem.
Yeah, I know, that's
one thing. But there is something which is referred to as a Tselem.
Ba?
Where?
Ba?
No. Ladies, you should know this.
In
Nebuchadnezzar's dream, those of us who learned Sefer Daniel together, remember that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And in that dream, he saw a statue. He wasn't willing to either remember the dream or reveal the dream, and Daniel revealed the dream to him and interpreted the dream, and he told him, there are four levels of your statue. The head is of gold, and the chest area is of silver, and then comes bronze, and then the legs were of bronze, the legs were of iron. And the statue was eventually destroyed. Do you remember what Nebuchadnezzar did as soon as Daniel interpreted that dream? No, not yet. You're missing. You're almost there. Right before Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were thrown in, he went and he constructed a statue. You don't remember this, ladies?
Yes.
And the statue that he constructed was what? What was it made of? It was all gold. And this was... Here, you have to look at that, Daniel, because anyone who reads the book of Esther has the book of Daniel in the background. Look at Kerek Beit in Daniel.
What chapter?
No, Perek Gimel, excuse me. What was that? Perek Gimel. Pasuk Aleph.
Right there.
Nebuchadnezzar Malka Avad Slaim Didahavu Meyamin Shitin Prayamin Shit Akime Bvikatura Bimdinat Bavel. Nebuchadnezzar the king created a statue of gold that was 60 amot high and 6 amot wide, and he set it up in the valley of Dura in Bavel, and then he sent to gather everyone together for the Chanukat HaTzelem, for the inauguration of the Tzelem. And look at Pasuk Dalet, Pasuk 4. V'karoza karei b'chayil, and an announcer called out strongly, L'chon amrina amamaya umaya v'lishanaya, to you we say, nations, peoples, and languages. These are all different kinds of people within the empire. Be'idana di tishmu'un kol karna mashrokita katros sabcha pesantarin sumfonia v'chozne zmarat tiplun v'tiskadun l'tzelem tahava di hakim nevuchadnezzar malka. When you hear the sound of the... Who can read this in English? Because okay. Sandra, read to us.
That when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, you shall fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up.
Keep reading.
And whoever does not fall and worship shall the same hour be thrown into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. That's what Chan Chavi said.
Yes, that's what Chavi was referring to. And then, of course, the Jews do not... fall into the Jews do not bow. Look at the source sheet. The third source, Shir Hashirim Rabbah, Parsha Zayin, Dibur HaMatchil Sod, the last source. Nebuchadnezzar Hemid Selem, V'ifrish Mikol Uma V'Uma Shlosha Shlosha. Nebuchadnezzar built a statue and appointed from each nation three men. Shlosha mikol Yisrael, and three from all Israel. V'chananya Mishael v'Azariah shayu ha-shlosha Yisrael amdu u'michu al atzmam v'lo avdu avodat kochamim. And Chananya Mishael and Azariah, who were the three men from Israel, stood up and protested. and did not commit idolatry. Second. Halchu lahem etzel Daniel. Amru lo, Rabbeinu Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar ha'emid tzelem v'yifrish mikol umavu umash losha shlosha v'lanu yifrish mikol Yisrael. Ma ata omer, nisgod lei o lo? They went before Daniel and said to him, our Rabbi Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar built a statue and appointed three men from each nation, and he appointed us from Israel. What do you say? Shall we bow or not? He said to them, Daniel answered, Amar lahem, Hinei ha'navi lifnechem l'chu etzlo. Daniel said, I don't want to call this one. The prophet is here, meaning the prophet Yechezkel, who lived in Babylonia. He lived in, do you know where he lived in Babylonia? Tel Aviv al Nahar Kfar. The name Tel Aviv is not a new name. He said, here is a prophet before you, go to him. Daniel said, I'm not going to call this one. I'm not going to answer this question. הלכו להם אצל יחזקאל, אמרו לו כמו שאמרו לדניאל, they went immediately to יחזקאל, they told him what they had told Daniel, shall we bow or not? He said, אמר להם, כבר מקובל אני מישעיה רבי, חבי כמעט רגע עד יעבור זעם. He said, I have a tradition from my master Yeshaya, hide for a moment until anger passes. אמרו לי, מה את באי? דיהון אמרין, הדין צלמה סגדין לי כל אומיה? They said to him, what do you want? That they will all say, in other words, the whole world will say, every nation bowed to this statue? This is the tzelem that we have in Tanakh. So come Chazal and say, when Rashbi says, they were punished by God because they bowed to the tzelem. It's this tzelem that's being referred to. And then you say to yourself, but wait, just a minute, you're 100 years later, earlier. Nebuchadnezzar was in 586 before the Common Era. Xerxes, Hashiarch, was in 486 before the Common Era. So 100 years later. Why is God punishing them now for a sin that was committed 100 years earlier? Pokei davon avot al banim. But we say that doesn't work, that God doesn't punish the sons because of the fathers. So why is God punishing them now for a sin that was committed 100 years earlier? And I think the answer has to be that the only way God will punish someone for a sin committed 100 years earlier is if they're still committing the same sin. And then you look and you say, what was Hashiarch, following Daryavish, out to do? He was out to conquer the entire world. I heard Rav Meidan say something very, I think, deeply insightful. He said, when you have two kings, it's easy to understand this, someone above them. But when you have one king who's ruling, who's governing the entire world, the feeling is there's no one above him. And Mipnei Shehishtachavu LaTzelem was Rashbi's way of saying the Jews had integrated into Persia. The Jews were part of the Persian desire to conquer the whole world. They identified, maybe they were part of the army. I don't know if they were part of the army. But he's saying they're part of this Hishtachvaya LaTzelem. Why did Nebuchadnezzar build the image? If you go back to the book of Daniel, which we studied together, you say he saw a tzelem, and his tzelem was divided into four stages, and he was the head of gold. And then eventually the tzelem was destroyed, and governance of the world was given to God's people. He's attempting, he's showing God, that's your version, but I've got another version. In my version, the whole statue is gold. And you know how I'm going to manage to have the clock stop at the gold? By having the whole world bow down to me. Once the world bows down to me, Hashemayim Shemayim Lashem V'aretz Natan Livnei Adam, the heavens are yours, but I can rule down here by getting everybody to bow down to me. And that's exactly what Darius was trying to do. Even though, for us, Darius is a good guy because he enabled us to begin building the Mikdash. but to rebuild the second Mikdash. But what he was out to do by conquering the Greek cities, the Greek poleis, is he wants to rule the world. And what does Achashverosh want to do? What does Chashiyarsh want to do? It's the same thing. He wants to rule the world. And saying Mipnei Sheishtachavu Natzela means that the Jews were cooperating. They were actors in the drama that he was scripting of conquest of the world. And once you have a king conquering the world, there's no room for God within the world, unless that king is representing God. But if he isn't, then there's no room for God in the world, and therefore Rashbi says, Mipnei Sheishtachavu Latzelem. Now that works if we follow the thesis that Chashiyarsh, that Achashverosh is Chashiyarsh, is Xerxes, and we correspond, we make this correspond with his life's events, which correspond very well. That's not the way Chazal see it. Chazal have a different reading. Chazal's reading of the Persian era does not correspond with the historians. You know where the Jewish calendar begins corresponding with the general calendar? You know, we sometimes look at our years and we say, the world is this many years old, but then we look at other evidence and we say, well, how does this correspond with each other? So there are ways of making Sheshet Yimei Breishit last for many years. But do you know when our calendar begins to correspond with the world calendar? It goes earlier. It goes to the Seleucid calendar. Minyan Shtarot is the rise of the Seleucids. Basically from the time of Alexander the Great.
311-312.
From then, the calendars coincide. But before then, Chazal have the Persian Empire having only three kings. The three kings, according to Chazal, are drawn from the book of Ezra. So look into the book of Ezra. The first king that we confront in the book of Ezra, he who conquered the Babylonian Empire is whom? First pasuk in Ezra. Koresh, Cyrus the Great. Look ahead when you see the attempts to halt the building of the Beit Mikdash, chapter 4, pasuk Dalet 4:4. Vayhi am haaretz merapim yedei am Yehuda umevalim otam livnot. These Samaritans were sabotaging the building of Beit Mikdash. V'sochim alehem yoatzim nafer atzatam. And they, these terms are so modern. They had hired people to sabotage their efforts. Kol yimei Koresh melech Paras, that's the first king, all the days of Koresh, v'ad malchut Daryavesh melech Paras, and until the kingdom of Daryavesh. And then in the next sentence, you hear about malchut Achashverosh, the next sentence, v'yimei Artashasta. So what Chazal do with that is they say, the first king was Koresh. Thereafter, the second king was Achashverosh.
A new era?
Don't talk about Xerxes, don't talk about Chashiyarsh, don't talk about ten kings, because Chazal have the Persian kingdom being a kingdom of a little more than 50 years, and only three kings. That's what Chazal speak about. What they do is they say it stretches from Koresh to Daryavesh, and in the middle you have Achashverosh, whose Aramaic name is Artashasta. And this Daryavesh the Great, whom we know as Darius the Great, according to Chazal, was the son of Esther and Achashverosh. And that's why he viewed favorably the reconstruction of Beit Mikdash. How you make sense of this in terms of historical dates, the only way you can do this is you have to expand the Greek period, because otherwise you're going to Otherwise, you're not going to be able to reconcile the dates. But I'd like to work with Chazal's thesis for just a moment. And I'd like to try to understand, according to Chazal's thesis, but this works also with the historical identification of Ahasuerus as Chashiyarsh. I'd like to understand what Nehenu Misudato Shel Oto Rasha means. Because we had those two options. Why didn't God intervene earlier? Option A says Rashbi, says his Talmidim, Shenehenu Misudato Shel Oto Rasha, because the Jews enjoyed the festivities. Option B, because the Jews bowed to the Tzelem. Now, I try to explain bowing to the Tzelem as meaning that the Jews were continuing the behavior of 100 years earlier in which everybody prostrated themselves before Nebuchadnezzar, and that's the way to enable a king to seize control of the whole world. But what is Nehenu Misudato Shel Oto Rasha mean? I would like to suggest, and this is true whether we take Chazal's identification or whether we take the historical identification, and there's a difference of maybe 50 years between the two identifications. You're dealing either with the very first days of Shivat Zion, or you're the return from Babylonia, or you're dealing with the middle of the period that we call Shivat Zion. Ezra returned Ezra and Nehemiah are about 90 years after Hatzarat Koresh, so the Cyrus Declaration. So either you're in the middle of that period or you're very early in the period. And when you look at the beginning of Megillat Esther, you say to yourself, there's a picture that's being drawn here. And one asks oneself why. Take a look at the beginning of the Megillah. Vayibi mei Achashverosh, someone else read. Who's reading? Harry, you said you can do this?
Yes, I can.
So please, read for us.
Vayibi mei Achashverosh, Amolech mehot v'yakush, Sheva v'esrim u'mei ha-medina. בימים ההם כשבת המלך אחשוורוש על כיסא מלכותו אשר בשושן הבירה בשנת שלוש למלכו עשה משתה לכל שריו ועבדיו חיל פרס ומדי הפרטמים ושרי המדינות לפניו.
Now pay attention to the next psukim, which describe, as Harriet is reading, if you prefer the English, as Harriet is reading, look at the English. Pay attention to the setting.
Laharato et osher kvot malchuto, yet yakar tiferet gedulato, yamim rabim shmonim, umeat yom, uvim lot hayamim haele. עשה המלך וכל העם הנמצאים בשושן הבירה למי גדול ביד קטן נשתי שבעת ימים בחצר גינת ביתן המלך חור, כרפס ותכלת אחוז בחבלבות בארגמן על גלילי חסף ימודי שש מיטות זהב וחסף על רצפת בהת ושש בדר וסוחרת.
A bit more, just one more.
השגות בכלי זהב וכלים מכלים שונים ויין מלכות רב כיד המלך.
Great. You've just brought us into Purim. How can someone describe to me Ahasuerus' garden? The first of the 180 days was held indoors, presumably. 180 days, why 180 days? Why not 160 days? Why not 120 days? Why not 200 days? I presume because 180 days is a half year, and in the Middle East, the rainy season is a half year, and people need to be journeying from place to place. So even if you're not outdoors, you still need to have 180 days maximum, the summer season, for your festivities. Now, afterwards, במלוא הימים האלה לבריאות, פסוק ה', עשה המלך לכל העם הנמצאים בשושן הבירה למגדול ועד קטן משתי שבעת ימים בחצר גינת ביתן המלך. Afterwards, the king made a party for everyone in Shushan, a mishte for 7 days. Where was it held? Ginat Bitan HaMelech means in the king's garden. Pasuk Vav, Sandra, read this to us in English.
There were white, green, and blue hangings.
Ah, no, it doesn't say hangings. It says white, blue, white, green, and blue. Achuz b'chavlevutz v'argaman. Your translation is interpreting, but it says white, green, chur chiver. White, green, celery green, and tchelet, light blue. Achuz b'chavlevutz v'argaman. Tied with ropes of linen and purple. Aglile chesef.
To silver rings and pillars of marble.
I wouldn't say rings. I would say poles.
Rods.
Yours says rods?
Rods.
Good. And then mitot, mitot zahav v'chesef, couches of
gold and silver upon a pavement of alabaster, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones.
Sounds pretty good. Can you tell me what chur karpas utchelet are?
Malchut.
Sadri, your translation, which I think the translation that you're holding on to, I think is misreading it, and I think most translations do.
Are
I've never seen
the hanging gardens of Babylon. Is that like you're thinking that's pleasure gardens?
So I don't
the seven
think
wonders
so.
Of the world?
I don't think so. I think that this is a tent.
Yes, it's a what?
It's a tent. I think it's a tent.
But they were known for the idea of this concept of pleasure gardens, and that was one of the seven wonders in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the Persians who have inherited the Babylonians. My guess is if you're going to have people coming en masse, and they're outside, you need to have something which is shielding you from the sun. And therefore, I'm imagining this as fantastic fabrics, which are, I don't mean a tent like a teepee, but these are fabulous fabrics which are stretched on silver poles which extend from marble pillars out in the garden. There are marble pillars. I presume this isn't the only time that a tent has been made there. And it's what?
That's a baldacchino, which is it's a fabric structure that's to create an outdoor room, the feeling of an outdoor room, but it's done outdoors, but it's with fabric.
I would presume.
It's a painting.
I would presume that that's what you have here.
And so party number one was indoors.
Party number one,
I presume.
Was the rainy season? No, not because it was the rainy season. I presume because then Achashverosh is receiving fewer people at any given time. And the idea being, during the 6 months, that he's conferring that with them, there is a council being held, people are coming, it is an open house, it's not that anyone is there for 180 days, but people are coming during the course of 180 days, and whether or not you identify Achashverosh with Chashiyash, you're still going to see people coming, the top echelon coming, he certainly is... Certainly is solidifying his rule, even if he isn't Chashiyash, who's planning to go out and attack the Greeks. But you look at this tent, which then he sets up in order to receive everybody at the same time. And you see this description of these fabulous fabrics. I mean, I picture this and I say to myself, well, what did the gowns look like?
Sorry.
No, really. You have a partial picture here. You need to complete the picture in order to be able to understand it. And the description is of v'chelim mikelim shonim. Vessels from different vessels. So the Midrash says, what does vessels from different vessels mean? It means he took out the kelim of the Mikdash. Do you see how the Midrash is getting that from the words vessels of different vessels? They were different from what?
From
all other vessels. But literally what this means, and this is brought by Rashi in the literal meaning, is individually handcrafted vessels. In other words, each one was different, each vessel was different from the next. Hashkot bichlei zahav. They were drinking out of golden cups or urns, and each one was individually handicrafted. Now, in order to understand what we're looking at, you have to say you're seeing only a partial picture. You're not getting the whole picture here. If you want to get the whole picture, you have to have the violinists there. You have to, not violinists, there are other
the musicians.
You have to have the
harp,
instruments,
the
there, the harps, the harpists who are playing at various places in the garden. I mean, I just want to complete this picture, because when you complete this picture, you'll then move elsewhere in Tanakh and say to yourself, I understand what he means. They mean Nehenu Misudato Shel Torah Sha. You have this fantastic tent. You have green and white, celery green, and white, and tchelet, light blue, and it's all tied with crimson ropes, white and crimson ropes, and the silver poles, and the couches are golden and silver couches, and you have inlaid floor outside. It's called a garden, not because there are... don't think dirt, think the it's just it's uncovered, but you have mother of pearl, you have alabaster, you have gems on the floor, and you have gold and silver couches and individually handcrafted golden cups. What do you think the food looked like? You can't possibly just have drinks. What's being told here is they're drinking the king's wine. Not good wine, the king's wine. The king's wine is just flowing freely. And there's got to be food there. There have got to be tables all around in which you can only imagine, or you can't imagine, the abundance of food. But I'm getting back to the gowns. I want to know what the gowns are. I really want to know. Because I'm picturing... That's fine. The gowns were there. In other words, the man and woman come together in their coach. They're coming in a coach which is drawn by horses. And they get out, and he's going to go his way. How is he dressed? What's their dress like? And what are the women wearing? And the picture is stunning. It's stunning until you do one thing. Until you say, well, what else was going on in the world at the same time? The picture is actually, it's glittering. It's glittering. It's you know, I'm sitting, I'm there like everybody else, looking with pleasure. The jewelry, what did the jewelry look like? I mean, one can just imagine. Or maybe one can't even imagine. But what was going on in the rest of the world at that time?
Operating.
Where? Turn to the book of Haggai. Haggai, towards the end, one of the last three of... third from the last of Treyasar. Now, what we're about to read will work both for the identification, both according to Chazal's identification and according to the historian's identification. Chagai Perek Aleph. Shlomit, do you have it? Chagai Zechariah Malachi. Find it. Here, let's wait for everybody to get it. Here, before Zechariah. Treyasar, right before Zechariah. Okay. Shlomit, do you have it? Could you read to us? Now remember, according to Chazal, who is Daryavish? He is the son of Esther and Achashverosh. But according to the historians, who is Daryavish? He is Darius the Great, who precedes Chashiyarsh, who precedes Achashverosh Xerxes. So read to us. Shlomit, please read.
בשנת שתיים לדריאבש המלך, בחודש השישי, ביום אחד לחודש, היה דבר השם ביד חגי הנביא, אל זרובבל בן שלטיאל פחת יהודה, ואל יהושע בן יהוצדק הכהן הגדול לאמור. כה אמר השם צבאות לאמור, העם הזה אמרו, לא עת בו עד בית השם להיבנות. ויהי דבר השם ביד חגי הנביא לאמור, העת לכם אתם לשבת בבתיכם ספונים והבית הזה חרב.
והבית הזה חרב?
ועתה כה אמר השם צבאות, שימו לבבכם על דרככם, זרעתם הרבה והווה מעט החול.
והווה מעט. זרעתם הרבה והווה מעט.
החול ואין לשובעה, שתו ואין לשוכרה, לבוש ואין לחום, לא.
Okay. Sandra, do you have the English for this?
I do. Or does some... It might be objectionable, but I have some. Should I read it?
Yeah, it's not your translation.
In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, saying, thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say that the time has not yet come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your well-timbered houses while this house lies
in ruin? It doesn't say well-timbered here. It says, is it time for you to dwell in your homes in refuge, sfunim? The habayit hazeh charev, in this house.
Swimming you translate as?
Hidden.
While this house lies in ruins, and there.
You know, in other words, hiding out in your homes.
So basically, it's an argument about whether or not to.
Yes, but with the reason exactly. Yeah. Go ahead.
You eat much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You dress yourself, but there is no warmth. And
do you hear? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes.
The picture here is the picture of life in Eretz Yisrael for the 42,360 Jews who heard the call of Cyrus the Great to go up to Israel. I'll get back to this in a minute, but turn to the beginning of Sefer Ezra. Go further on. Tehillim, Mishlei, Iyov, the Megillot, Daniel, and then Ezra. You're near the very end of Tanakh. And look at the beginning of Sefer Ezra. I'm beginning to read. Uvishnat achat lekoresh melech paras, lichlot var Hashem mipi Yirmiya, heir Hashem et ruach koresh melech paras, ויעבר קול בכל מלכותו וגם במכתב לאמור. כה אמר כורש מלך פרס, כל ממלכות הארץ נתן לי השם אלוקי השמיים, והוא פקד עליי לבנות לו בית בירושלים אשר ביהודה. מי בכם מכל עמו יהיה אלוהיו עמו, ויעל לירושלים אשר ביהודה, ויבן את בית השם אלוקי ישראל, הוא האלוקים אשר בירושלים. וכל הנשאר מכל המקומות אשר הוא גר שם ינשאו אנשי מקומות בכסף ובזהב וברכוש ובהמה עם הנדבה לבית האלוקים אשר בירושלים. And in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, at the end of the word of God to Yirmiyahu, that's the end of the 70 years, God awakened the spirit of Koresh, king of Persia, and he sent a voice out in all of his kingdom and in writing, saying, thus has spoken Cyrus, king of Persia, all of the kingdoms of the earth did God, the God of the heavens, give me, and he commanded me to build him a house in Jerusalem in Judea. Who amongst you from his people, may their God be with him, may his God be with him, and he will go up to Jerusalem in Judea and build the house of Hashem, the God of Israel, that is the God who is in Jerusalem. And all who remain of all of the places where he lives, the people of his place will lift him up with silver and gold and property and animals, all contributed to the building of the house of God in Jerusalem. In other words, anyone wants to go up to Israel, go up to build the house of God, and the rest of you buy Israel bonds. And this is what Cyrus the Great said. Look at Perek Beit, the end of Perek Beit, and you'll see the numbers of Jews who heard the call of Cyrus the Great. Pasuk Samach Dalet, Pasuk 64, Kol ha-kahal ke-echad arba ribo alpaim shlosh meot shishim. All of the congregation like one, 42,360. Those are the number of Jews who went up. And then you go back to the book of Haggai and you say, well, what happened to the Jews who went up? You know, you have this call, Cyrus the Great gets up and he's God's puppet. And he says the time for return to Jerusalem has come. And how many Jews get up? And he says, anyone who wants to go up, go up. And the rest of you...
give money.
Give money. What?
He gives money.
And he gives money, and he gives karbanot. And how many Jews go up? And what happens to them when they get there? What happens to them when they get there is that they are beset by enemies from every direction. They come up and they're singing Hatikva, you know, Shir HaMa'alot B'Shuv Hashem Et Shivat Zion Hayinu K'cholmim. And they get there, and what do they find? They find, like in Ezra Perek Dalet Vayishma'u, I'm going back and forth between the different books. In Ezra Perek Dalet, you hear Vayishma'u Tzareb Yehuda Vinyamin Ki Bnei HaGola Bonim Hechal Hashem Elokei Yisrael. The enemies of Judah and Binyamin heard that the returnees from the exile were building a temple to Hashem, the God of Israel. Vayikshu Azrubavel V'Rashei HaAvot V'Yomru Lehem Nivnei Imachem Ki Kachem Nidosh LeElokechem. They approached Zerubbabel and the heads of the families, and they said, we will build together with you, because like you, we too pray to your God. And to him we have been sacrificing since Esar Chadon, the king of Assyria, exiled us here. ויאמר להם זרובבל וישוע שער ראשי אבות לישראל, לא לכם ולנו לבנות בית לאלוקים, כי אנחנו יחד נבנה להשם אלוקי ישראל. כאשר ציוונו המלך קורש מלך פרס. זרובבל and ישוע, the Kohen Gadol, and all of the heads of the families of Israel said, it is not to you and to us to build a house to our God, because we together, in other words, the Jews, will build for our God as Koresh, king of Persia, has commanded us. And then you read of the beginning from here and through the entire book of Nehemiah, you read of the attacks upon the Jews and the attempts to halt the building of the Beit Mikdash. If they couldn't internationalize it, they were going to halt it. And then you go to the book of Haggai and you read Zera'atem harbe v'have ma'at. You have planted much and you are bringing in little. You're not. This isn't a description of people starving to death, but it is a description of people who are always hungry. You have what to eat, but you're always hungry because there's never enough. Shato ve'ein l'shochra. There's never enough. You have what to drink, but you couldn't possibly become drunk on what you have. Lavosh ve'ein l'chol. You have what to wear, but you're never warm enough. You are never warm enough. It never happens. You have what to wear. You're not walking around naked. You have something to eat. Your children have something to eat. But it's never enough. And someone who has work, someone who has work, his wallet has a hole in it. And by the time he gets home, there's no money, and he doesn't know where the money went. Because he put the money in his wallet. But it disappears, he doesn't know. This is what's going on in Israel. And let's make it worse by reading Nehemiah Perek He. Nehemiah Perek He is after Xerxes. In other words, this situation is lasting for the entirety of the early period of Shivat Zion. Nehemiah is around 440 before the Common Era. Ezra is around 450 before the Common Era. So the Purim story is located somewhere between Cyrus the Great and Nehemiah. No matter where you're locating it on the scale, you're going to locate it before Nehemiah. Take a look at the situation still during the time of Nehemiah by looking at Nehemiah Perek He, chapter 5. Vatihi, Shlomit, do you have the sound of your
yes.
Read. Does anyone, look as Shlomit is reading in Hebrew, look at the English if you prefer that. El Achehem means Al Achehem. The Raza, you have the English. Read as... Oh, you're reading the Hebrew. No. Stay in the Hebrew. We don't want you to go over to the English. Who's reading in the English?
I have the
English. Okay, go ahead, please.
Then there arose a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren, the Jews.
El Achehem, against their brethren. Let's read Pasuk by Pasuk. Go ahead, please. Hebrew.
ויש אשר אומרים בנינו ובנותינו, אנחנו רבים ונכחת הגן ונוכלה ונחיה.
English?
We, our sons and our daughters are many. Let us get for them corn that we may eat and live.
In other words, people are saying what?
We need help.
We need help. We're starving. And they're crying out against their fellow Jews.
ויש אשר אומרים שדותינו וחרמינו ובתינו אנחנו עורבים ונכחת הגן ברעב.
Okay. English, please.
Some also there were that said.
Wait, Claire, could you read that again?
This is the way it
is. No, that's...
Yeah. Some also there were that said. We are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our houses. Let us get corn because of the dearth.
Do you hear what occurred between one pasuk and the other? In the first pasuk, they say, we need grain. In the second pasuk, they say, we're mortgaging our homes. What occurred between those two pasukim? Those who had the grain said what? Well, we'll give it to you, but we can't give it to you
for nothing.
We can't give it to you for nothing. So they answered that what? Well, we'll mortgage our stotenu, kamenu, vatenu. We'll mortgage our families are starving. We'll mortgage our fields and our vineyards and our homes. Go ahead.
V'yesh asher omrim lavinu chesif. למידת המלך שדותינו וחממנו.
Go on, please.
ועתה כבשר אחינו ושרינו כבניהם בנינו. והנה אנחנו
כובשים
את בנינו ואת בנותינו לעבדים. ויש מבנותינו נכבשות ואין לאל ידינו ושדותינו וכרמנו לאחרים.
Go on. Claire, please read. No, Claire, please read. Va'ata v'yesh asher omrim lavenu kesef lemidat ha'melech.
4. Okay. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute upon our fields and our vineyards.
The king's tax upon the fields and vineyards.
Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants. And some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is it in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and our vineyards.
In other words, what's the picture? You have people coming and saying, our families are starving. And those who have the wherewithal say, well, we're prepared to give you, but we can't give you for nothing. And there are people who say, well, we'll mortgage our homes and we'll mortgage our fields and our vineyards. But there are other people who say, but we can't mortgage our homes and our fields and our vineyards because we've already mortgaged our homes and our fields and vineyards in order to do what? To pay the king's taxes. And now, what's happening to our children? Our children are being sold into slavery. The creditors are coming and they're taking our children. And we have no way of protecting our children, because we have no we can't feed our children, and our creditors are taking hold of our children. So it's very hard to say this, but there's a split screen going on of what's going on in two places in the world at the same time. And when you look at the vast wealth in Shushan, and you look at the glittering life in Shushan, and you think of the ball gowns with which people are coming, I keep seeing a couple get out of their carriage that's drawn by white horses, and you see the fabulous gowns, and people are going and drinking out of gold vessels. I'm not talking about ne'numisu da tosha la tovasha, that the food wasn't kosher. It's not what I'm talking about. First of all, the gezeira about yayin nesach is during the Roman period. So I'm not talking about yayin nesach, and I'm not, maybe all they were doing is eating pistachio nuts. You have pistachio nuts from Iran. I don't know, grapes and pistachio nuts. But the point is, I believe that what Chazal are saying, what Talmidei Rashbi are saying, is why did Israel deserve punishment? Because there was an indifference to there's an indifference to Tzion, that you have two places in the world, and in one country, in Persia, you have the Jews living royally, and the Jews are part of the glittering scene, and in the other part you have people who are starving. Those people who are building up the state, people who are starving, people whose children are being sold into bondage or taken by their creditors, those people who are eking out a meager living as they're beset by the Shomronim and the Adumim and the Ashdodim. And read the book of Nehemiah and you'll see everybody who sought to keep the Jewish state from rebuilding itself. So you have a handful of Jews, and the split scene, the split screen between the two becomes incredibly painful, as you say to yourself, how could there? It's not just the question of the of Ahasuerus's banquet. It's I think that the attempt here is to contrast the Jew in one place in the world and the Jew in another place in the world. And, you know, today we live in a global village. Today, in so many ways, we live in a global village. So you live here, your children are there, your relatives are there, you live in one place, your heart is in the Libi Bamizrach, Bani Besof Ma'arav. And we travel all the time. I mean, I was thinking as I was preparing this, I was thinking of Rabbi Lookstein in the middle of the Intifada, taking, you know, when everyone is terrified of going to Israel, so what's he doing? He's bringing people to Israel. But that's not the picture that Chazal are giving for here. They're describing Persia, it seems to me, Persia and Yehuda. And the question arises, so where is Jewish history taking place? You know, which is the real story of Jewish history? Where is, who's writing Jewish history? Is Jewish history being written in Persia, in the glittering palaces? Or is Jewish history being written by that small handful of Jews who are sacrificing in order to be, who are sacrificing and who are living lives of tremendous privation? And I think what Talmidei Rashbi and Rashbi are both saying, there are two sides to the coin. Rashbi is perhaps looking at the religious side, Mipnei Sheishtachavu Natzelim. He's saying the Persian kings are being made kings of the world, and the Jews are participants. They're actors in this. And if the Persian king becomes king of the whole civilized world, then there's no room for God in the world. It's the old story from Babylonia. Or you're looking at it on the social national level, and you're saying, and it would seem to me that read in that context, that the comment of that they disturb destruction is that the Jewish world needed to be shaken up, that the Jew needed to see that Persia wasn't the menucha v'nachala, that Persia wasn't the final destiny. And that's what this Megillah does. It tells you that, yeah, you can be living the good life in Persia, but you've got to know that the good life is transient. That you never know what's going to happen to you. You just don't know. And that becomes the message to the Jews that enables them to reorient themselves towards a national existence which is centered in Israel. It's a tough message. It's a tough message, but I think it's a message that Jewish history has learned. It's food for thought.
What's part two?
Part two is going to be upbeat. Part two is going to be very upbeat. Okay. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What's remarkable is how things don't change.
Isn't it amazing? You know, you think to yourself.